I believe we made it up to slide 12. Am I right on that?
Maybe it's just slide 12.
But I got through 11 is what I mean. I haven't talked about 12 yet, but that's where we're at. Slide 12 shows you something that should already be familiar. This specific example isn't really the point, but what we have in this specific example is the breaking of a disaccharide, table sugar, sucrose, into the two constituent monosaccharides by breaking what sort of bond between them? No, that's not a type of bond. A glycosidic linkage, right. That's all review stuff. That's not the point here. The point here is that this is a hydrolysis reaction like you identified. Actually, that's not the point either. The point is that it's a reaction, and in biochemistry, effectively all reactions are sped up or catalyzed by the help of an enzyme, and that's what sucrase is. Sucrase is an enzyme, you can tell, because it ends in ASE. A lot of enzyme names end in ASE. And enzymes can be named for various reasons, but there's two major ways that enzymes are named. One is for what the enzyme does, in other words, what it helps out, what kind of reaction it helps out. And some of them are named for the substrate. Substrate is just the name for the reactant of a catalyzed reaction. And this is an example of an enzyme that's named for the substrate. The substrate is sucrose, that's the sugar. The enzyme is called sucrase. And enzymes work in various ways, but to understand how an enzyme works as a catalyst, how it speeds up a reaction, in other words, we first need to look in slide 13 at a generic reaction that is not being helped by a catalyst. So this brings up a point I think I've mentioned before, namely that a catalyst is never required for a reaction because it's not a reactant, right? The reaction is possible without a catalyst, but it's just much slower. Well, here we have just not a real reaction. It's a generic example. There's no chemicals called A, B, C, or D. Those are just, they represent atoms, though. And you have free energy versus time on this graph. Progress of the reaction is just another way of saying time. But before the reaction occurs, you, of course, have some number of reactants. And if the reaction occurs, then you end up with some number of products. There's a rearrangement of bonds, or I should more explicitly say that in any given chemical reaction, some bonds are broken and some new bonds are formed. That's how you end up with different stuff. All right? And that does not just happen instantaneously. It doesn't just blink into product without any passage of time from reactants. And that's because in order to get to the products, you do have to break some bonds and form new ones, and therefore there is a intermediate substance that is not reactant and it's not yet product that's somewhere in between, called the transition state. And notice the transition state is represented here with a squiggle bond, indicating that it's bonds that are either in the process of being broken or in the process of being formed. Okay, now, before we get into the transition state any more deeply, just looking at this graph, how would you categorize this reaction on energetic terms? What kind of reaction are we looking at? It's what? It is exergonic. Even if you didn't have explicitly stated here the fact that that delta G is negative, you could tell that, hopefully, just by the definition of delta G, right? which is final minus initial. This lower free energy minus this higher free energy means it's going to be negative. But you can also just look at this and see that it's energetically a downhill reaction. So it's releasing energy. It's exergonic. Well, the point of this slide, though, isn't true for only exergonic reactions. I don't have a slide to show you, but I can quickly draw what an endergonic graph would look like. An endergonic graph would start with a lower free energy and go to a higher one, so it would look like that. But what you notice here is that regardless of what kind of reaction it is, endergonic or exergonic, the transition state, which is somewhere between reactants and products, something you have to go through in order to get to the products, has a higher G value than either the reactants or the products. That's this peak in the graph. All right? So that means any reaction, if it's going to happen, needs to get over that hill. Needs to get over this this transition state's G value. On the exergonic reaction, this would be the value that is graphed here as E sub A. E sub A stands for the activation energy, or energy of activation. And notice that E sub A is how much additional energy above whichever G value is higher the transition state has. All right? Now, the delta G always depends only on the G of the products and the G of the reactants. That's it, right? It's always G final minus G initial. Okay? And notice that delta G, therefore, does not at all depend on E sub A. Is that clear, graphically speaking? Okay. But the delta G tells you that energy is going to be released. The energy of activation tells you how likely it is for that reaction to happen. Because the higher that E sub A is, the higher the hill that you have to get over, the less likely that just energy from the heat of the system is going to be sufficient to allow it to get over that hill. Energy of activation, or activation energy. This is without the help of a catalyst. Now, 14 is exactly the same graph in black that we just looked at. But at the same time, you have the red trace, which is exactly the same reaction, only helped out with an enzyme. Enzymes are catalysts, so they help out. This shows you how catalysts in general, including all enzymes, work. This is why they work. They do it in different ways depending on the specific catalyst, specific enzyme. But enzymes in general do something to reduce the value of E sub A. Notice that the hill got shorter. And therefore, it makes it more likely that the available heat in the system is enough to get it over the hill. All right? That's how all enzymes work, by reducing E sub A, reducing activation energy. And just as importantly, notice that the enzyme does not at all change delta G. Delta G only depends on the products and reactants' G values. So enzymes never change delta G. They only change E sub A. All right, now to 15. Here we have a before and after picture of an enzyme and its specific substrate. Always keep in mind that enzymes are specific, meaning they work for only a certain kind of reaction. They are specific for a substrate. The substrate is the reactant. It's going to get turned into product, but it's going to do that in a catalyzed reaction. The substrate is going to get turned into product in a catalyzed reaction by binding temporarily to the enzyme. The enzyme is the big blue protein here. Well, enzymes have their specificity, meaning they work on only a certain kind of substrate, because of their specific shape. This is true for protein function in general, not just enzymes. Enzymes are just one type of protein functional category. Proteins in general work the way they do because of their shape, and enzymes are no exception to that. So there is one place on the surface of the enzyme that has just the right shape to fit that kind of substrate. And that place, which is where the substrate binds to the enzyme, is called the active site. And there's already a good fit before the binding occurs. Kind of like the lock shape for a specific key shape, right? There's a good fit between the two. Well, this is yet another example of a ligand binding to a protein, right? All enzymes are proteins. A ligand is simply a particle that binds to a protein, and that's what's happening here. Well, what do I keep saying is the general consequence of a ligand binding to a protein? Yeah, you have a shape change, a conformational change in the protein. And so I said that a little bit ago that there's already a pretty good fit between the active site and the substrate. If the substrate is present, therefore, it will bind. But that binding event causes a shape change in the enzyme so that the fit gets even better. Kind of wraps around it even more, notice. And that's called induced fit. To induce means to bring about. So the fit is made even better. It's induced to be even better by the binding of the substrate to begin with. And I usually compare this to a good firm handshake compared to someone who doesn't really get involved, just sticks his hand out, doesn't really grab on, but then you have someone who really wraps their hand around in the handshake. That's what induced fit is like. And that not only makes it a better fit even, but it also isolates the substrate more from the surroundings, making it more likely that whatever this kind of enzyme does it better. Now, I said in the last slide that all enzymes operate by reducing activation energy. That's true. That can be done in different ways, though. For instance, if you have a substrate like sucrose in the slide we started with today being broken into chunks, then maybe the binding of the substrate distorts, you know, once that shape change occurs, maybe that distorts or stresses the bonds enough so that they more easily break. That's one way of reducing activation energy. Or if you have an enzyme that brings two substrates together to build a bigger thing up, you know, without the help of the enzyme, they might come into contact with each other, the two substrates, but it might be pretty unlikely that they're going to come together in just the right positions. But if they bind to an enzyme, it might bring them into exactly the right configuration so that they can react with each other. So there's different ways to accomplish the reduction of E sub A, but all enzymes do it somehow. And that's why it speeds the reaction up. And it's usually many millions of times faster, the reaction, than it would be without the help of the enzyme, which is why in an organism, if you can control enzymes, you basically can turn on and off reactions, because without the enzyme's help, yes, it could still be possible, but it's happening so slowly that it's effectively off. This is how we control biochemistry. All right, 16 is just a cartoon example of a couple important facts. One is that, once again, you have this induced fit. It's not real so obvious the way they drew it, but once bound to the substrate, there's a change in conformation. Now, when the substrate or substrates, however many there are, binds to the enzyme, then that temporary combination is called the enzyme-substrate complex, pretty straightforward terminology. But that's a temporary complex because the substrate gets turned into product and then released. So there's an unbinding of the product from the enzyme, and that leaves the enzyme unbound again, but this is a hallmark of catalysts in general, not just enzymes. Catalysts are not reactants. They don't get turned into products, so after they've been used, they're free to go again. They just are infinitely reusable, basically, as long as the enzyme is there. And this actually brings up an important point, because if you still have substrate around and you still have this enzyme around, it's going to continue to work, meaning that reaction is going to happen whether you want it to or not. And this is why it's important for cells to be able to control their enzyme so that they can keep it from happening if they want to keep it from happening. They do that. You can think about this in two major ways. You could force this enzyme to stop working and therefore to turn the reaction off by destroying the enzyme, right? That would be one way. That would work. But if in the next moment you need it to actually turn back on again, then you wouldn't be able to use this enzyme anymore because you just destroyed it, right? You'd have to go back to the gene that is the set of instructions for how to build the protein. You'd have to go through transcription, then translation, assemble a brand new copy. That would work as well, but it would take some time and it would take energy to do that. It would be much better if you could somehow switch enzymes on and off without actually destroying them. That would save energy and time. And there is a way to do that, which we'll talk about in a minute. 17 shows you a couple more graphs, and there's two graphs here because of something I've talked about, which probably going to seem like a long time ago now, but I told you in a different chapter that the shapes of proteins can be affected by environmental variables. And there are two variables that are particularly important, because even a slight change in either one of these two variables can fairly drastically change the shape of the proteins and therefore affect their ability to function, because shape is everything for proteins, including enzymes. And I don't know whether you remember or not, but those two variables that can change the shape of proteins are pH and temperature, which is why you have a graph for each of these here. And the point here that's being shown is that any given enzyme has an optimum temperature and an optimum pH. What the values are for those depends on what enzyme we're talking about, but any individual enzyme works best at a specific temperature and works best at a specific pH. If the temperature is different from the optimum or the pH is different from the optimum, it might still work, but not as well. We can see this by the traces here. So on the top, temperature is on the x-axis, and you have two different enzymes, one from each of two different organisms. The black trace is for an enzyme that is working in a human, so it's a human enzyme. The red trace is for an enzyme that does the same job. It's for the same reaction, but it's not a human enzyme. It's from a thermophilic or heat-tolerant bacterium. Thermophilic bacteria not only survive temperatures that would kill just about anything else, they actually thrive at those high temperatures. The boiling point of water, they can survive. So you can see that there is a peak in each of these traces. Well, the peak is the optimum, in this case, temperature. And notice where the optimum temperature is for the human enzyme, at about 38 degrees, which is average human temperature. And this is not an accident. This is how natural selection works, right? There have been variations of this enzyme because of mutation over the years, but natural selection favored the one that works best at the temperature that humans exist at. And the one for the thermophilic bacterium doesn't work well until you get to the high 70s. By then, the same enzyme in a human would not work at all because that's so hot it would totally denature the human enzyme. But that's just the right temperature for a bacterium that lives at those temperatures. So that's optimum temperature. On the bottom, we can see the same kind of traces for optimum pH, but in this case, it's two enzymes doing a similar job, digesting proteins, but both of these enzymes are from the same organism, from humans. Different parts of the body, though. The black trace is from a stomach enzyme. Well, the stomach is by far the most acidic part of your body, pH of 2 or below. And notice that the optimum pH for this enzyme is just below 2. Well, that's just right for that condition. But, of course, it's no longer called food once it's in your stomach. It's called chyme by that time. That doesn't really matter, but it doesn't stay there forever, right? It then goes to the next part of the alimentary canal, which is the first part of the small intestine. And that is a drastic change in pH. So the enzyme that was working perfectly in the stomach actually gets destroyed because the pH is now suddenly closer to neutral, which is a huge shift. And notice that way up here, this one falls to 0. It gets totally denatured as well. That's no problem, though, because even though that enzyme is now worthless, the duodenum, the beginning of the small intestine, secretes its own enzyme to do the same job, but it's a different version that works well at the pH of the intestines. Okay. 18. Now let's talk about switching or controlling enzyme function. Well, in A, we have normal binding. That is everything we've talked about so far. Just an enzyme specific for some sort of substrate, has a good fit because of the shape between active site and substrate, and therefore if they're both present, substrate and enzyme, their binding will occur, and that is just normal binding, so-called normal binding. In B, though, this is something we haven't talked about. This is called competitive inhibition. Well, first of all, the inhibition part of that phrase refers to turning off or turning down the activity of the enzyme. Okay, so there's two ways you can switch an enzyme. You can switch it off or switch it on. Inhibition is what we call it when we're switching the enzyme off. And if we switch it on, that's called activation. So activation and inhibition are the two major ways to control enzymes. But the other word in this phrase, competitive, is a specific kind of inhibition. In competitive inhibition, what makes it competitive is that the substrate, which is normally what can bind to that correspondingly shaped active site of the enzyme, has to compete with a different particle that's not the substrate, the blue thing here, called a competitive inhibitor, has to compete with that inhibitor for the same active site. This is what makes it competitive. A competitive inhibitor is a particle that can bind to the active site of the enzyme. All right? And if it does so, then that particular enzyme, you never have just one enzyme, you have millions of copies of them in the cell. But that one enzyme, as long as a competitive inhibitor is bound to the active site, might as well not be there. It's switched off. Because even if there is substrate, it can't fit into that active site anymore. It's blocked by the inhibitor. All right, so that's competitive inhibition, because the two kinds of particles that can bind in there are competing for that one enzyme's active site. If the competitive inhibitor wins that competition, though, and binds, it doesn't get turned into anything. It's not a substrate itself. It's just a particle that can block the active site. Okay, C is a little bit different. Here we have non-competitive inhibition. So it's still turning it off. because that's what the inhibition word means. But the fundamental difference here is that the inhibitor, which in this case is the orange thing, is a particle that binds to the enzyme somewhere other than the active site. That's why it's non-competitive. They're not, the substrate and the non-competitive inhibitor are not competing for the same place on the enzyme to bind to. Well, how is it that the binding of this inhibitor to somewhere other than the active site could affect the active site? Right, it's another example of a ligand binding to a protein, and that's going to change the shape of the protein, including the shape of the active site. So the active site is still open, but now it's deformed and therefore doesn't fit the substrate even if the substrate is present. So this enzyme is also turned off, at least for the moment. Either one of these two in B and C are turned off only for as long as the inhibitor is bound. If the inhibitor falls off, if it unbinds from the protein, the enzyme, the protein is going to change shape back into its original shape and therefore be turned back on. Now, another word for non-competitive is allosteric. Okay, allosteric refers to the binding of a control molecule to somewhere on the enzyme other than the active site. Well, let's temporarily go back to competitive inhibition. Hopefully, just looking at this cartoon, it will make sense to you that you couldn't have such a thing as competitive activation, right? If it's competitive, then the only thing that the competitive control molecule can do is inhibit, right? Because it's blocking it. Well, for non-competitive or allosteric control, it could work either way. You could have an allosteric inhibitor or an allosteric activator. And that's what hopefully is shown on the next slide, if I'm remembering correctly. Yes, 19. This particular example features an enzyme that is multimeric. So it's one of these proteins that are made of more than one polypeptide, right? In this case, four identical polypeptide subunits, each of which has its own active site in this case. So it's really four enzymes in one, but it's all one big protein. Anyway, the overall enzyme, the multimeric enzyme, has two shapes without anything bound to it that it can assume, and they're about equal energy, so that it just keeps flipping back and forth or oscillating back and forth between these two shapes many times a second. Notice, though, that one of those two shapes is the so-called active form and the other one is inactive. The active form is so-called because when it is in that shape, all of the active sites are the correct shape to bind the substrate and therefore work as an enzyme. The substrate is the blue thing down on the bottom. All right. When it's in the inactive form, of course, it can't bind. But it's continuously going back and forth between active and inactive. Unless you have some sort of allosteric regulator, a particle that is binding to somewhere other than the active site. And there's two possibilities. The green thing is an allosteric activator. Because if it's present, then the place it binds will lock it into this active form. It'll keep it from oscillating. All right? If the red thing, on the other hand, is there, this is an allosteric inhibitor because it will bind in such a way that it will lock it into the inactive form, keeping it turned off. Well, only if you have the allosteric activator are you going to be able to have substrate bind to the active site and therefore have the reaction occur. Yeah. Yeah, an allosteric regulator is one that binds to the enzyme anywhere other than the active site. So it's another name for a non-competitive regulator. All right, now 20. This slide will refresh your memory about feedback. We've talked about feedback mechanisms, the fact that there is negative feedback and positive feedback, right? Which one of those is involved in homeostasis? Negative feedback, because it's the only one that can negate the error. Well, here we have a biochemical pathway. And the specific example doesn't matter, but in this case we have threonine as the initial substance that we start with. And the cell stepwise turns that into eventually isoleucine. That's the end product. But it turns threonine into intermediate A, and then intermediate A into B, and so on. That's why it's a pathway and not just one reaction. And as we've already talked about, each individual reaction of the pathway is catalyzed by its own specific enzyme. Okay, so if all of the enzymes are present and you have threonine to begin with, then this pathway will be turned on and you'll eventually be making isoleucine. The cell, let's pretend at the moment, needs some isoleucine for whatever reason, and therefore it's appropriate for this pathway to be turned on. And as long as the cell continues to need isoleucine, it will continue using whatever isoleucine gets formed. And in that case, there really isn't an error, right? Because the cell is meeting the demands. Eventually, though, the cell will have enough isoleucine, and it'll stop using any more that gets created. And in that case, then isoleucine will start to build up. That is the error in this case. The error of having too much isoleucine. Okay? Negative feedback is the answer whenever you have an error. Because negative feedback reduces that error somehow. Well, the way it happens in this case is called feedback inhibition. So, compare this to the previous slide. We talked about allosteric regulators. In this case, isoleucine, which is the product of the reaction pathway, is itself acting as an allosteric inhibitor. So the more isoleucine builds up because the cell is no longer using it since it doesn't need it anymore, the more likely it is that this amassing amount of isoleucine is going to be able to interfere by binding to enzyme 1 in the reaction pathway. It's doing so allosterically because it's not binding to the active site, it's binding to somewhere else. But that deforms the active site, and therefore enzyme 1 is no longer able to bind threonine. Well, that's going to shut down this first reaction step. But that has the effect of shutting down the entire pathway, right? Because you can't get to the second step unless you first go through the first step. Notice, by the way, that you could also turn off further production of isoleucine by any of these other enzymes, deactivating any of these other ones. You could turn off enzyme 5, and you would still not continue to make isoleucine, which is appropriate, right? You don't want to make any more isoleucine. But why is it that most cells shut off the first enzyme? Why did it evolve that way?
To save the energy?
Yeah. Why go through the time and energy of making these other intermediates if you're not going to go through the whole pathway? So you nip it in the bud by turning off enzyme 1. Well, that's negative feedback because you're no longer going to be making any more isoleucine. You've stopped the error from getting any worse. Eventually, the cell is going to need isoleucine again, and so it'll start using the isoleucine that built up from the previous time the pathway was being operated. And the more the isoleucine that's on hand gets used up, the more rare it gets, the more likely it is that it's going to leave the enzyme that it's stuck to, and that's going to allow the enzyme to go back into its normal shape, and that will automatically turn the pathway on again, just like it's supposed to. And then it'll turn off again when it's built up too much again. So just, it's automatic control, but it's allosteric control, and it's called feedback inhibition because it involves something feeding back into an earlier part of the process. I think that's the end of that chapter. Yes, it is.